many people have heard this story before? One person has heard it. Two people have heard this story before. Three. Okay. How many people were shocked to find out that something like this would be in the Bible? Yeah. Yeah. I have never heard this preached. I've never seen it in the lectionary. It's one of my favorite stories. It's the first one we studied when I was taking Old Testament in seminary. And when I was heading off to seminary, let me tell you, God called me to seminary in, called me to ministry in April of 2005. And God has a terrific sense of humor, because right after I felt the call to ministry and got all geared up to join, to enroll in seminary, I found out I was pregnant and we were about to sell our house, pregnant with my second child. And seminary was really not an option at that moment. I did not think I could do all of those things. So I ended up staying close to home, postponing a year, and then attending part-time in Oregon at a seminary before I moved down to Berkeley to go to Pacific School of Religion. And a few years later, in 2008, I was preparing to leave for Pacific School of Religion. And let me tell you, it was not a smooth exit. Everything was falling apart at the last second. So we see something similar in this story. And this is an extraordinary story for many reasons. The first thing we see is that we have overwhelming odds. We have God asking Deborah to do something about the Canaanites, but they have overwhelming forces. You keep hearing about these 900 chariots of iron. That's letting you know that they had chariots, that they lets you know that they have cavalry. The fact that the chariots are made out of iron lets you know that they have superior technology. And the fact that they had been ruling over the Israelites for 20 years lets you know how effective this was. So when we look at this story, the first thing we see is that we have overwhelming odds against the Israelites. This is an insurmountable problem. Do you see that? Huge, huge problem that they eventually overcome in this very strange way that you heard about at the end of the story. The other thing that we see about this story that makes it extraordinary is the fact that there is a female judge. Now, Israel went through different forms of governance before it got to the Roman Empire that we hear about in the New Testament. At this point, it's during the time of Judges. This is a system of judges and leadership that Moses set up when they were still in the desert. Remember, people kept coming to him with their squabbles, and they kept coming to him to sort out their problems, and he ended up spending all of his time serving as a judge for people with all of their legal problems. And he got tired of it. So his father-in-law, who was mentioned in this, his father-in-law said, you know what you could do? Why don't you pick the best, smartest, wisest, most even-handed person from each of the tribes, the 12 tribes, and let them serve over each of their own tribe. So when people have their problems, they can come to them. And they can choose their own people under them to deal with the lesser squabbles, the petty thefts, you know, the minor issues. And only if it's a really big problem that none of the other lower judges can solve should they come to you. And that will save you a lot of time. And he thought about this for a while, and he decided it was a good idea, so he implemented it. It's very much like our current court system, right? We have lesser courts, then we have the higher courts, and we have the superior courts, and then we have the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court does not deal with all of the petty theft cases. They only deal with the biggest ones. So after Moses transferred his leadership to Joshua, Joshua transferred his leadership, and so on, until we get to Deborah. And it's an extraordinary thing, because she was effectively in charge of all of Israel at that point. Do you realize that? She was the most powerful person in the land because the judges were in charge. This was pre-kings. There were no kings at this point. And it's interesting because she's a woman. She is the only female judge that we see in the book of Judges. And she's a powerhouse. She's not just judging Israel and leading Israel. She's commanding armies. Did you see that? Deborah is commanding armies, 10,000 men strong. That's different. That's interesting. She also is a prophetess. She has a direct link to God. God tells her what's going to happen. God gives her instructions. She hears them, and she's able to implement what she needs to do, command the army to save the day. Deborah is an extraordinary woman in the Bible. And we don't often hear about her, but I wanted you to hear about her today. We also have Jael. She's another interesting woman. She is not a judge. She is not a prophetess. She is the wife of a clansman who existed outside of Israel. She is not an Israelite. She is not Hebrew. She is not Jewish. She's a Gentile. And yet, it says that her husband was of the descendant of Moses' father-in-law. So there's this long generational connection back to the Israelites. Even though she's Gentile, there is that connection. And so we see these two powerful women that save the day when Israel is under threat by overwhelming forces. The other thing that's interesting about this story is its structure. It has a fascinating structure. And it's indicative of other structures that we see elsewhere in the Old Testament. You may not be aware of this because most people don't read ancient Hebrew or biblical Hebrew. But when we look at the Old Testament, it's all full of riddles and word games and structural plays, like the Book of Lamentations. You would never know this, but each verse starts with the next letter of the alphabet. It's in alphabetical order. And there's all sorts of number games they call gematria, where letters represent numbers, and if you add them up and play with them, they mean different things. But you would never know this unless you read the original Hebrew. You see that with the number of the beast, right? The number 666, that's number games. That's gematria in Hebrew. And we also see an interesting structure, which I'll get to in a minute. So a couple years had passed. I had built up credits at the Northwest House of Theological Studies in Salem, Oregon. And it was time for me to transfer to Pacific School of Religion. And so I did that. I filled out all the paperwork. I got ready to go. And I was going to be going down with my two children. Rosemary was 2. Faye was 5. And, you know, I had a plan. I was going to have like a truck and, you know, we're going to attach it and the car and put it all together so I could take down furniture and everything that I would need to be able to live in the student housing at Pacific School of Religion. And let me tell you, everything fell apart. There were no trucks available. Even if I'd been able to find one, it would have been thousands of dollars to drive it to one way to California and then have them transport it back. So I tried to find like a big trailer that I could attach to the back of my car. And that didn't work because the car wasn't structured to be able to hold a trailer. It would have just ripped the entire rear bumper off the car. And so there was this last-minute panic, but I had to go because orientation was starting in 3 days, and everything suddenly fell apart. And I realized that I was going to be attending orientation, and they didn't provide childcare. And they had us, I saw the orientation schedule, 14 hours a day they had us in orientation and activities. You know, between the workshops and the orientation schedules and the tours and the evening activities, the get-to-know-yous, there was no way I was going to be able to do that with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. My truck fell through, so I didn't have furniture. I did not have furniture. Me and 2 kids, right? I only had what I could fit in the car. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I got down there, how I was going to attend orientation and all this sort of stuff. It was a mess. And yet I had to go. I had to go anyway. So we look at the chaotic, this structure of this story. And you'll find that in the Old Testament, and sometimes in the New Testament as well, that stories have what's called a chiastic structure. This is from the Greek letter X, because when you map it out, it makes an X shape. And what that means is the first part of the story, the first line of the story, is perfectly mirrored and resolved by the last line in the story. The second line of the story is perfectly mirrored and resolved by the second to last line of the story. Do you see what I mean? Let me give you an example. The very first, have I lost you all? You're all still with me? Everybody's just sort of like, I see eyes rolling into the back of their head. Let me give you an example. Okay. You know what my Russian professor used to say when he would ask, does this make sense? He says, is this clear? He would say, is this clear? He'd say, it's clear as mud, but it covers the ground. That's what he would say. So, for example, the very first line of the story, we find out that God is punishing the Israelites via the Canaanites. The very last line of the story lets us know that God is now punishing the Canaanites via the Israelites. Do you see how that mirrors one another? But it resolves the problem that's in the first line. Okay? The second line talks about Sisera, He's named the head of the enemy army, and there's a description of his extreme cruelty. Right before the ending of the story, we find out that Sisera is dead of a very cruel and brutal death. You see that? Perfectly mirrors one another, perfectly resolves the problem. Okay? We see in the third section, Deborah is introduced as a very capable and very effective leader. Okay? And then right before the end of the story, Jael, mirroring strong woman who is not Israelite, demonstrates her superior cunning and strength and defeats Sisera. Do you see that? They mirror one another. One resolves the other, okay? And so on down the four. So the only way you can really describe this, I'm going to show you my little paper here. You have the first line mirroring the last line, the second line mirroring the third line. Do you see this? Can you see? You can't see the text, but you can see the shape, right? And if you draw a line like this and draw a line like this, you have the letter X. In Greek, that's chi, right? Chi, chiastic structure. This story has a chiastic structure. And there, what's interesting about a chiastic structure is that when you look at how all of these things are resolved, you usually end up with the center of the X. There is always a center of the X, and that's the most important part of the story that the author is trying to tell you. So I want you to think for a minute about what the center of the X would be. So I'm in my car. I have my kids. I have their clothing. I have my clothing. I have 80 pounds of potatoes from our garden, because I refused to leave my 80 pounds of potatoes that had five different colors that I had planted and nourished along all summer, 14 spaghetti squash, because the spaghetti squash were in season, that I had picked. I had tucked them here and there around the car. And I was like, I got me, I got my kids, I got our clothing, I got my purse, and I got 14 spaghetti squash and 80 pounds of potatoes. I'm ready. We're doing this. Even though everything else was up in the air. And I remember thinking, well, we'll get there and we can sleep on the floor and just eat takeout or something until I can get up on my feet and figure that out. I don't know how I'm going to do that if I'm attending 14 hours of orientation per day, but I'm sure something will give. But I knew that I had this call, that God had asked me to do this, and that if something were to happen, if God was calling me to do this, something would happen to fix this. Something would happen to fix this. And so I was driving down the highway from Portland to Berkeley. It was a two-day trip. It was a two-day trip. And I knew that once I got there, it was actually even going to be a push to try and get there before 5 o'clock when the housing office on campus closed so they could give me the keys to let me in. So the center of the chiastic structure in this story is when Deborah is reassuring Barak. He's worried, right? He's the commander of the army. And did you notice he is afraid to go out without her? Isn't that interesting? She says, go. And he says, I'm not going out there unless you're coming with me. I'm not going by myself. You have to come with me. And she says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. The Lord is indeed going out before you. And she says, this is not going to be your glory. You are not going to win this. Sisera will be delivered into the hand of a woman. So he gets a very interesting prophecy. It's very similar to like when Moses was told, you've brought the people this far, but you don't get to take them to the promised land. You have to stay here, and you have to say goodbye here. You don't get to lead them into the glory of taking them across the Jordan River. You stay. Just so you know, this is what's happening. Thank you for your service. You've done your part, and now it's done. Same thing with Sisera. She tells Barak, you know, Sisera is not your deal. You get to go out and fight. You summon your men. You go fight those chariots. But Sisera, you don't get to have him as your gold star on your armor. A woman will take care of that. He doesn't know who. Deborah doesn't know who. She just has the prophecy. And when he's afraid, she says, the Lord is indeed going out before you. Overwhelming odds. Total chaos. Fear on the part of the general of the Israelite army. And the center of the story is, the Lord is going out before you. You don't know how this is going to end. You only have a very small part in it, but God is going before you to prepare the way. God will take care of this for you. You just do your part and trust, and the rest will be taken care of. You don't need to worry about that. The Lord is indeed going out before you. And then we see the story resolve. We see one piece by piece, it all comes together. We see that Sisera is defeated. We see that the army is defeated. We see that this link, the corresponding parallel verses, talk about Jael and how her husband was a descendant of Moses. And then later we find out that this tribe was an ally of the king of Canaan. So we see that there's this duel. Which direction are they going to go? Are they going to be loyal to the Israelites? Are they going to be loyal to the Canaanites? It's resolved. She is loyal to Israel. It all falls into place. Sisera is defeated. The battle is over. The Israelites are saved. It's all taken care of. And what's hard for each of the individual people to see is that their part is important even though they don't do everything. Jael cannot go out and fight all those 900 chariots of iron. That's not possible for her. But she can do one part. She can lure in Sisera and defeat him. Deborah cannot be in two places at once. As the prophetess and the judge of Israel, she was located many, many miles from where Jael was located and where Sisera ran to. She could not possibly, if she was supposed to be the woman into whose hand Sisera was delivered, she can't be in two places at once. She can only command the army and give the prophecy. And Barak, he's busy commanding the army. He's got these 10,000 men he's organizing to fight the 900 chariots of iron. He cannot also pursue Sisera, and you see him try, and it doesn't work. He doesn't get there in time. Sisera runs too fast, and he gets away. All of these people have been asked to do one thing that adds to the greater whole. And it works because God went out before them, and because they just tried to do their part. No one tried to get all the glory. No one tried to take over everything. They listened. They followed. They trusted. And we can give them credit for their part in it, but nobody gets all the glory in this story. Nobody gets all the glory. They all get some of it. They all get a pat on the back, but nobody gets all of the glory. So as I'm driving in my car down the road, I get a call from my sister-in-law. And she says she was at this point running a Montessori school out of her church. And Rosemary was too young to attend school. Remember, she was 2 years old. And she says, I just want to let you know there's a space for your children if you'd like it. And I said, oh, well, I can't afford. There's no way. Do you know how expensive private school is? Montessori school? And she says, that's okay. They're my nieces and I want them. Whatever you can pay will be enough. And I got down there at 4:58 p.m., 2 minutes before the housing office closed. And as a matter of fact, the guy who ran the housing office was just coming out of his office to leave. So I ran into him in the middle of the courtyard when I got there. And I ran into someone else, too, actually. He was not the first person I met. I ran into an international student named Wang Wu. He was from Korea, and he was studying to be a minister. And he said, hello, welcome to PSR. And we had a handshake, so I knew somebody. And he's still one of my closest friends. He is now serving in Korea. But we got to know each other, and he was a great source of support and friendship for me throughout my seminary career. And the person who was in charge of housing, his name was Stephen. He came, and he had the keys with him because he figured he was going to get a call from me like on his cell phone hours later, so he kept the keys with him. So he just walked me straight down to the apartment. And before he opened it, he said, I want to apologize to you. Your apartment is not ready. I'm so sorry, he said. I'm so sorry that it's not ready for you. We haven't had a chance to clean it and clear out all of the furniture and all of the stuff that people left in the kitchen. There's still tons of pots and pans and silverware and dishware in the kitchen, the couch, the dining room table, the chairs. They're all still in the apartment. I'm so sorry. We can clear those out on Monday. Let us know what you'd like to part with, if not everything. I went to my first orientation, and we were put into small groups immediately. And the question they said was, let's talk. The discussion topic goes, what's the most challenging thing for you since you have started here? And I said, childcare. And the woman sitting to my right, who is still one of my close friends, said, well, you know, My teenage daughter is here. She's 17. She loves to babysit. She's not doing anything. Let me text her, see if she's available. She can be here in 10 minutes. So I had coverage for, I didn't go to every single orientation activity. I couldn't spend 14 hours a day away from my children, but I had coverage when I needed, so I could go to those get to know you activities so that I could attend the orientations and the tour and the workshops. That night, my first night, my mother and my brothers appeared with my brother's pickup truck and a futon, so we had a bed to sleep in that night and a bunch of takeout Chinese food. And let me tell you, every time someone showed up at my apartment to say hello, I gave them a spaghetti squash. Everybody at PSR had spaghetti squash for dinner that night because I had 14 spaghetti squash. And you know what? It was helpful because, as strange as it was, it stuck in their memory and word got around. So I wasn't an anonymous person anymore. I was a spaghetti squash lady, but I was the one who was friendly and shared her garden produce, which when you're living in the dorms and all you're eating is cafeteria food was a big blessing. And I started to get to know one another. And within 24 hours, when I had been called to this overwhelming, impossible, insurmountable request from God, I realized that it wasn't all about me. I didn't have to do it all by myself. God had prepared the way. God had prepared the way. And there were friends and furniture and food and shelter and childcare waiting for me. And I don't get to get all the glory. I don't get to say I did it all by myself. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. I single-handedly made it through 2 master's degrees all by myself without any help from anybody else. I don't get to get that gold star. And that's okay because there was a synchronicity that happened, just like in the story with Deborah in jail. There were people that I didn't even know that were already working to make this happen. And I was already working, though they didn't realize it, with my spaghetti squash to make them happen, to make their degrees happen, to make their journey happen, to help build bridges, to help bring people together. I ended up starting a parents group. We had 30 different families showing up every Thursday for potluck and play in the courtyard. I think I've told you about that. Remember the fight over the car? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was our parents group. It evolved into our parents group. And we all helped one another, and nobody gets the glory. But God was calling all of us to do something. God is calling every single one of us to do something extraordinary, to do something that is most likely overwhelming. And she's asking us to do it without getting all the glory. She's asking us to open our minds and open our hearts, to trust that she has prepared the way, that she is going before us, and that if we just do our part, if we listen, if we follow, everything else will fall into place. Things will come through that when we least expect it, and we'll be okay. It's a powerful story. It's the center of the X. The Lord is indeed going out before you. Say it with me. The Lord is indeed going out before you. Turn to your neighbor and tell him, the Lord is indeed going out before you. You don't get to get all the glory. But you don't have to do it alone. You don't get all the glory, but you don't have to do it alone. Can I get an amen to that?
Amen.
Amen.